I'm Leah Simone Bowen, the host of Podcast Playlist on CBC. We're a podcast discovery show, and we love a great story. So each week, we highlight the podcasts we think you should check out.
The show is a classic.
Love how they select their topics.
It's great.
And from time to time, we're joined by some of the biggest names in podcasting.
My name is Jamie Loftus.
John Green.
I'm Michael Hobbs.
My name is Nicole Byer, and I have a podcast recommendation.
You can find Podcast Playlist on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Well, it's not every day that a musician walks into our studio with a record under his arm and then opens it and takes out dice and says, "Do you want to play?" But Kid Koala is not your typical artist. He's ostensibly here to talk about his new record, which is also a board game. But he's also here to talk about what happens when you switch from classical music to turntables, how trying new things means you have to accept failure, and how having kids changes you as an artist. Kid Koala is coming up. Plus, speaking of having kids, you might have found yourself in the early days of the pandemic with kids around, kind of dedicating your entire life to them, feeling like you were losing who you are outside the home. Jill Barber, the Canadian musician, felt that way. And one day she dropped off her kids at school in a daycare. She came home. She sobbed. She picked up a guitar and she wrote songs about it. She's here to talk about her new album, Homemaker. Jill Barber, coming up. I'm Tom Power. You are listening to Q. Have you ever had like a great idea and you didn't do anything with it? You know, like, oh, a frying pan made out of margarine, or like, oh, it's a cake shop, but it only sells savory cake. I'm going to do something about that. But you never do. The Canadian artist you're about to hear is basically what happens if those flash ideas were not only executed, but executed by someone who is incredibly talented. Take a listen. The music you're hearing right now is by Kid Koala, or Eric San, who, and as you might be able to guess, is a Canadian turntablist, a DJ, music producer. But he's also, let me get the list here, scored video games, created comic books, built cardboard turntables, and then has taught his audience how to mix using them so they could play with him, created live puppet shows, and now made what is technically an album. It's called Creatures of the Late Afternoon. But when you open it up, it's also a board game with 150 cards and dice, all hand-drawn and made by Kid Koala. Creatures of the Late Afternoon is out now to listen to and to play with. But where does that creative energy come from? How do you go from classical piano to turntables in the first place? What happens when you have a big creative idea and it doesn't work out? Here's my conversation with Kid Koala, but we start out by playing some of the game together. Nice to have you here. How's it going?
Awesome.
All right. Can you take me through what we're on the radio?
Yes.
What am I looking at here?
You're looking at the gatefold jacket for the album actually unfolds and becomes your game board.
So the LP record,
yeah,
you know, opens up. That's typically where the liner notes and all that stuff would be. But
exactly.
It's a board game.
It's a board game board, and then you have the inserts that have 150 musical instrument playing creatures on them, musical instruments, recording device cards, studio time cards, life experience cards, etc. And you're trying to create your own creature band and record music in different genres and save the Natural History Museum through the power of tunes.
Can we play a little bit? Can you show me how it works?
Sure. Here, you can roll.
So I have two dot.
Yeah.
Die? Dice?
Two die. Or die. Two dice.
Two dice, one die.
I guess.
Right? Something like that, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mitch, our producer, Mitch, he knows this stuff. Two die, one dice. Got it. So I got the two die in my hand. And by the way, they're foldable,
yes,
cardboard die. Like, they're not your, you know, traditional.
Exactly.
It's great. These come with the record.
It comes with the game. Everything fits in the
right
record pack.
I'm already doing it. I'm nervous. I'm going to get snake eyes here. Let's do it. Three and a one.
All right. Here we go. One, two, three, four. Oh, right. See, you hit a whammy. It says lost keys, lose studio time. So you would have lost your studio time card at that point. But
okay,
you would have
okay
started with three. So you still have studio time to do two songs.
Okay. And then these cards say?
Those are studio time. So basically, as you go around the board,
yeah,
you see these game pieces are little touring minivans. And you go around and you go to these apartment parties. And when you land on an apartment party, you can draw a card like that, and you see that you have a bass player creature.
Yeah, I got Walsh Walrus, the bass player.
Yeah, and I have Simon the Star-Nosed Mole, vocalist.
Right.
So when you're putting your band together, you need to have a vocalist, a bass player, and a drummer. Then you need to have, you go to the flea market, so you can land on these flea market squares and you draw musical instruments or recording
Yeah, I just drew
devices.
A magnetic disc recorder.
Yeah.
Recording device. And I also got a stylus synthesizer.
Exactly. Right. So you're putting your instruments, your recording devices, and your band together. And then, of course, what's the main part? Every song is your inspiration. So when things happen to you, like broken heart,
You land on the broken heart piece.
Say you land on the broken heart piece, you'll lose a card, but then you'll also gain life experience, and life experience might give you something like emotion, or it might give you something like a song genre card, like a breakup song or a workout song or whatever real life experiences actually inspire you to make music, because that's true too. So this is actually, I don't know, it's semi-documentary,
autobiographical
type of game.
What do you mean it's semi-documentary and autobiographical?
Well, I would say, for instance, if you land in this dig time space, you see all these three rows of square cards in the middle. I wanted the game to be a bit interactive. So on the vinyl, besides having your album tracks, I put a lock groove at the end of each side. And then past the lock groove, there's these hidden vinyl-only board game tracks. And those are actual timers and soundtracking moments for the game. So if you land on, say, Dig Time, you have to go play the Dig Time track in the board game track, which is a hidden track on the vinyl. And that acts as like a 90-second timer with a funky little beat with scratches and stuff. And you're trying to, say, at that point, play the matching game. You know this game, like memory. You just try to make pairs. And if you get pairs, then you can trade that for other creature cards and stuff to put your band together. And that's a fun little interactive vinyl moment.
Well, that was my question was going to be like, how does the record match with the board game? But now it makes sense. So like, for people who don't know, like that would mean the record will run out eventually, but then you can go past where it runs out by lifting it up and moving it somewhere else, and you can get access to some specific things
to
for the game.
Other tracks right close to the center sticker, I put these hidden tracks that are just for use with the board game, and it's not part of the album. It's just for use with the board game.
Why are you interested in making a board game about the inspiration that comes to making a career in music, though?
I know you
got to answer me that one.
Why? I don't know. It's kind of what I know. I'm just trying to share my story. That's really what it is, you know. So even these memory cards, as you're flipping these over, say there's a bag of chips. Here's some pens. Here is a turntable stylus. These are all things, incidentally, on my backstage writer.
Oh, okay. I got a record here.
Yeah, you might recognize this. Sandwiches.
I got a sandwich, yeah.
You know, veggie plate, all those things.
You're sharing some. What inspired you to do this?
I think I was playing a lot of board games during the pandemic with my daughters.
Yeah.
And at one point, I was thinking about the packaging for this album, and I said, oh, it'd be fun for it to just have another use besides just storing the audio from the album music.
Yeah.
I was like, can we use the package idea and turn it into something that people could play?
The music on the record, not associated with this, the record came first. The music on the record came first.
It kind of all came at this, sort of evolved at the same time. I was in the studio recording, and whilst I was doing that, I was watching a lot of nature shows with my younger daughter, Ruby, and we were learning about all these creatures, you know, fantastic creatures and shows like Blue Planet and things like that. And so learning about the mantis shrimp that has the fastest punch under the ocean and things. So I started painting these creatures, you know, in just for fun. I just started painting them on canvas, but I would actually have them, you know, playing a drum machine or a guitar or something. And that would be, several dozens of portraits of these musical instrument playing creatures in the studio hanging on the wall. So they became kind of populating my headspace a bit.
Oh,
and when
God.
I went into the studio, I kind of decided, all right, well, what would this sloth sound like if he played a fuzz bass? Like, what kind of bass line would a sloth write? And then I would try to start there, you know, with the catalyst for the song. And then I took those audio bits. So I played all the instruments, and then I recorded those stems and cut them to vinyl on my record cutter, and then I scratched everything back together, sort of like a self-remixing kind of exercise. But I had the time. I mean, that's the thing. It was a three-year project, so it was kind of fun. And I was off tour, obviously. All the tours were postponed, so I had plenty of time to do all this artwork and, you know, try new things in the studio.
Some people did nothing during the pandemic. Some artists, you know, found it really hard to create during the pandemic. Oh. You're not one of those people. You found it very...
No, I was, you know, just trying to learn how to do stuff. And, you know, even the painting, even the board game, I think, I don't know how many tens of thousands of dots are on these creatures in the board game, but I'm a huge fan of the Impressionists, and Seurat's Le Grand Jatte, one of my favorite paintings. And I heard he took maybe 2 years or something to do that painting. So I went and I bought these giant 8-foot by 4-foot canvas, and I said, I'm going to paint this game board by hand. Part of me was hoping that I'm just going to call from my booking agent saying, hey, you know, the venues are all open again and the tour's back on. But while that wasn't happening, I was just painting little dots until this whole game board happened. But it was fun, you know, I was just trying to catch some of that inspiration.
It's really impressive. I mean, but I think it's sort of like, I think there's nothing I can say that has ever been able to sort of characterize the work that you make. But like, I don't know that much about like how you started in the first place. Like, how did you get into turntabling? Do you remember like falling in love with turntabling?
Absolutely. When I was 12, I started on classical piano first. Actually, I just noticed you guys have a Steinway piano in your green room. How cool is that?
And right
you have
there.
Another one right here.
And that's the one Glenn Gould used to play.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah, had I known, I would have showed up 4 hours early for this interview just to play.
You can hang out 4 hours afterwards if you want. You know, we're not going to kick you out. Don't worry about it.
So I started on classical piano, but I had actually a very strict teacher and strict conservatory upbringing that is always like, play this song exactly like this. Don't deviate. Don't swing it. Don't, you know, just do it this way.
Yeah.
And otherwise... You won't do well in the exam, or you won't do well in the competition, and this and that. And I kind of got a little bit bored with that scene. But around age 12, I discovered this turntable scratch scene was going on, where it was completely different. It's like, whatever you do up there, you got to do something no one's ever heard before, at least not that night.
Where did you find out about that?
Just through mixtapes and hearing about, like, I was in Vancouver at the time and hearing scratching for the first time.
You just heard like the scratching sound.
And I knew just from playing piano, I knew this sound was being performed, even though it was very futuristic and just totally foreign and alien sounding to me, in terms of, I can tell that's a human sentence or human voice that's been chopped up and rephrased, and certain syllables like doubled and tripled on time to make a rhythmic solo out of it. And it was so intriguing to me. Oh, somebody practiced and learned how to do this. So it was an immediate thing. It was immediate. How did they do this? You know, what's going on here? I went up to the clerk. I said, what's this playing? You know, where can I buy this kind of music and learn about it? And he pulled out a few of the records of the stacks and showed me. Yeah, this you'll hear this is called scratching. You'll hear it on these albums, and showed me even some pictures. There's one of Jazzy Jeff. And you see, this machine's got two record players, and the machine in the middle is called a mixer, and this is how they cut the sound back and forth and on and off. And it's a combination of that and the records. And I didn't know what he was saying, but I said, okay, I believe you. I'm going to start with just buying these records and listening to
them. And you bought turntables shortly afterwards?
No, not shortly afterwards. I actually had to save up for a year and a half. My mom wouldn't buy me turntables. I was, you know, I went through a lot of phases where, like, I need a skateboard now, or I need a BMX bike. And I was like, you know.
She was like, yeah, we'll see if you want turntables.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was one of those things where she said, I'm not going to, that's a very expensive purchase, but if you save up your own money, that I'll take you to the shop. Like, I'll drive you to the shop. At that point, we'd moved to, by the time I'd saved up enough to buy one turntable, one mixer, we'd moved to the States. We were in the Maryland area, and she actually drove me up to Bensonhurst, New York, to to pick up my first turntable.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I still have the receipt from that. So,
but I think that would have been, it would have made sense then if I had only ever talked to you about being a turntables for the rest of your life. And then you would like, you know, you go on tour and you, but like you've done so many different things. I mean, last time you were here, we were talking about the video game you created. There's a board game I'm looking at right now, composing and drawing and building and filming. Like, where does that come from? Was there a teacher? Was there an artist? Was there anyone who encouraged you to like, don't hem yourself into one thing?
I've always drawn. I'm a bit of an introvert ever since I was a kid. I was one of those things. I could always escape into drawing. So if I was acting up or acting out at a restaurant or something, my parents would say, here, Eric, here's a pen. Like, draw on the placemat. And then I'd be gone. Like, you wouldn't hear from me for the rest of the meal. Just there creating stuff. So I think that's always been just a part of expression or me recentering myself. But I think the first time I realized that I was interested in production was seeing Charlie Chaplin films when I was about 6 years old. That was the first time I remember what was on TV was deliberately made to create this sort of magic feeling. And prior to that, maybe it was my parents watching the news. It was like, oh, it's not interesting. It's kind of like, that's really happening and it's not. You know, as a kid, you like cartoons, you like those types of things, right? But Charlie Chaplin, I remember my mom saying, hey, we're going to watch a movie with your grandparents and your sister and your father and I, and we're all going to watch the same movie. And I was like, eye roll, no, come on. And she threw on Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. And I remember the first couple seconds, I was already pushing back. Oh, this is some old timey. It's not even in color and there's no talking. What's this? But then after a minute, I was there. I said, This is incredible. All three generations of my family laughing and enjoying the same thing or crying at the same poignant moments. And even back then, I remember something happening in my brain where I said, you know, I don't know what this is, but whatever feeling that is happening here in the living room with all three generations of my family enjoying this art, I want to do that in the future. I don't know what that is, you know. I didn't know what that meant. Like, does that mean you're in the set design department? Does that mean you're in the
You knew there was something behind.
I learned, yeah. Because I said, oh, there's no way. I mean, in that film, he's in the factory working on the conveyor belts. And at one point, he gets like sucked into all the cogs and wheels of the factory. And I realized, like, oh, this is real. They built that. That's actually the size of the room or bigger than my bedroom, whatever this contraption is, mm-hmm. in the scene. And I realized, what is this? Like, is this real or did they make this just for this scene? And, you know, so obviously I learned eventually that it was somebody's idea that they created and put it in there, framed it in a way to present it to entertain people. And I think that's definitely, you know, something that's just part of my DNA still. I think even the new shows that we do definitely nod to that in terms of it being a live film with 8 cameras and 75 puppets and 20 miniature sets and a string quartet, but there's no dialogue. Everything's told, you know, through the action and the framing of the camera and the music.
So I think I understand now. I think I am wrong to think of you as a musician who does a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, music is always involved.
Yeah.
For sure. But I think even with my first album, it wasn't like, oh, I'm trying to make a 3-minute hit song and like shoot up the Billboard charts or anything.
No.
I mean, the stuff that I was trying to create were stories, really. Because my first records were the 7-inch read along storybook records. So they had music, they had voice acting, they had sound design and sound effects. They also had illustrations. They also had text to read along to. So it was a whole universe, essentially, of things that you can escape into. So now if you look at something like this, like, to me, packaging an album this way just makes perfect sense.
Is storytelling. I mean, you were so inspired by these like read-along records, which were, again, like voice and music and stories. And
multidimensional.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you really managed to keep such a sense of freedom in your work over the years. Like, you never seem to have felt hemmed into doing anything. You never seem to have been told, like, constrained by your ambition or anything like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just as fantastic as this stuff. Fantastic. By fantastic, I mean, like, fantasy style. Like, oh, it's a story about a mosquito, or it's about a robot trying to write love songs, or it's, you know, a group of creatures trying to save their habitat through music. It does come a little bit from real life or life experience that way. I just have some, I don't know, a different way of expressing it. I think the turntable always helped me do that. I remember, like, one of the songs that's like a real heart moment for me on this album was When You Say Love, which is a track that I was helping my parents clean out their storage container. And they said, oh, you have space at your house. We don't want to pay for the storage unit anymore. Can we just leave your boxes at your house? And I'm like, okay. You know? Yeah. And as I'm going through the stuff, I find these suitcases. And one's just full of letters, like chock full of letters and reel-to-reel tapes. So I asked my parents, what's up with these reel-to-reel tapes and all these envelopes? And my father and my mother had met at a school function right when he graduated. She was a couple of years younger than him, and it was an after-school function, like a little dance thing. But 2 weeks later, he was moving to Canada. He was moving to the West Coast to go to UBC.
Yeah.
And but it was a love at first sight moment. And but you know, he was a broke student on the West Coast, and he was paying his way through school and paying for school and his housing, doing all these odd jobs. Couldn't afford long-distance calls, couldn't afford to fly back to Hong Kong to see her. So instead, what they did was they wrote letters constantly, two a week, they said, each way. They wouldn't even wait for a reply. You know, they would just be like, how was your exam today? And then already write, well, today I did this and this and that. Oh, and they would just, and that constant contact for 7 years.
Wow.
7 years they didn't see each other. They just had these letters going back and forth. And also, my father would tape, you know, the pop songs off the radio at the time, like the Brill Building tracks, the Run It, Shangri-Las, and those types of things, you know, and tape them and put them on these reel-to-reels and send them to my mom, and he would transcribe the lyrics onto, you know, for her to read, and that's kind of how she practiced her English. That's how she learned English. I know, it's so sweet.
It's
like,
so beautiful.
I was like crying when they're telling me the stories. Like, you should never throw these away.
Yeah.
Like, these are the most precious thing. This is the heirloom, I think, from grandma and granddad. It's like that, you know, just the romance level alone and the dedication. And so during the pandemic, my daughters made this cute, you know, happy anniversary video for my parents. And I said, I want to make a track to score it. And so I wanted to make one of these kind of 50s, 60s jukebox jams for them. And that ended up being When You Say Love. But I wanted to do it, you know, my style, like all off turntables and stuff. But it's really the story.
Let's play that, hey? Let's play that coming out of this interview.
Sure.
I mean, it's so beautiful. I love it whenever we get a chance to talk.
Yeah.
Want to do one more roll before we go?
Yeah, hit it.
Okay, I'm going to do that. Ready? That's the sound of the die.
Mm-hmm.
Six.
One, two, three, four, five, six. Dig time.
What does that mean?
Well, at that moment, if we had a turntable set up here, which we don't today, but we would play the dig time track.
Uh-huh.
That would start. It would be a 90-second funky timer, and we would start to match cards here.
Oh, okay.
As pairs. So that's how we would go. Oh, you got two skateboards. There. Great. So once you've found a pair, you can trade it for one of these flea market cards or one of these apartment party cards. And
I'm so excited to I told you when you came in, I played Floor Kids, your video game with my family. I'm so excited to play this game with my family, too. Thanks
awesome.
For coming in. Lovely to see you.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Eric San, a.k.a. K. Koala. His new album / board game, Creatures of the Late Afternoon, is out now. We'll be right back. song inspired by Kid Koala's parents. It's called When You Say Love. Family, a big thread in the conversation I had with Kid Koala. Not just talking about his folks there and talking about his own relationship with his kids, but the board game he brought in is meant to be played with your family. If you do so, let me know you did it. I'm at Tom Joe Power on Instagram. That's from his brand new album, Creatures of the Late Afternoon, which is out now. Coming up on the show, the new ballet Bisselwyn is getting a lot of attention in Canada right now. So two of the folks behind it will be here to tell you about the moment they sat in a room together, listened to a song by Jeremy Dutcher, and immediately everything clicked, and how that moment led to the creation of the first Woolstock Ballet. Plus, Jill Barber, the Canadian musician, is reevaluating who she is as an artist and a parent, and she'll be here to tell you about it. It's coming up on Q.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
It's our time. It's the time of our people. You know, we have to look around us and see all the wealth that this nation has and all the beauty around us. And I'm looking forward to moving this way so that others can come up behind me.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. So this ballet I'm going to tell you about, it's called Bisselwyn. And in some ways, it's a traditional sounding ballet, you know, incredible dancers, really amazing technique, a very emotional musical score, you know, your classic story of a hero struggling with evil. But the Atlantic Ballet's Bisselwyn is anything but traditional. It's being called the world's first Woolstock Ballet. It comes from members of the Wolastoqiyik indigenous peoples in New Brunswick. By the way, as you've heard on the show before, there's maybe only 100 or so speakers of the Wolastoqiyik language. And making this ballet a reality took a special kind of collaboration between the community and the dance company. Bazazam Paul is a multidisciplinary artist from Sedansis First Nation, a champion grass dancer, and director of Indigenous programming with the Atlantic Ballet. It was his initiative that got the ball rolling. He and Igor Dobrovolsky, who is the artistic director and choreographer at the Atlantic Ballet, they brought on Bazazam's good buddy Jeremy Dutcher, whose music you're hearing right now, to create the music. And Jeremy, as you may know, is a Polaris Prize-winning musician and is himself Wolastoqiyik. Bisselwyn had its world premiere in Fredericton last week. It's now touring across New Brunswick. I caught up with the ballet's co-directors, Bazazam Paul and Igor Dobrovolsky, just before the premiere of the show. Thank you so much for being here.
It's awesome to be here, Quay.
Yeah, awesome, yeah.
Bazazam, I know you've done some projects with Atlantic Ballet before, but take me back to a few years ago and how and where and why you proposed this project.
Yeah, so like you said, Atlantic Ballet and me have done quite a lot of work together. And then Susan Chalmers-Govan, who is the CEO at Atlantic Ballet, had a wonderful relationship with me, and we were sitting there one day in her office, as I would after I did gigs with them. And I sat there and I said, you know what? I think it's about time. I'd like to do a ballet. And she said, well, you're asking the wrong person. You know, you got to go ask Igor. And I was like, okay. So I did. I walked out of the office and caught Igor in the hallway. I said, Igor, I'd like to do a ballet with you.
Did you have any details yet of the kind of ballet you wanted to do when you pitched it to Igor?
No. At that time, I knew that if we were going to create a project, that I didn't want to come in heavy-handedly with something that's already pre-written. I really wanted to work collaboratively so that we all kind of knew the ins and outs, so nobody would be lost. You know what I mean? Like we all creatively were on the same page.
When did, Bazazam, to stay with you, when did the idea come to you then to do this specific work?
So, of course, as you mentioned at the top of the show, my really good friend, Jeremy Dutcher, dropped his album working with my grandmother. And, you know, they were on the back porch and he was singing with her, learning how to sing our traditional songs. And I remember hearing him sing in his style, and I was like, wow, you know, this is it. This is something I really want to work with. And then really when I came to Igor, that was where we started. We played Jeremy's new album in the studio, and both of us were quiet for a good like 2 minutes after listening to one of his songs. And Igor looks at me and I look at Igor, and we both kind of nodded, and we said we could work on this.
Your grandmother's Maggie Paul.
That's right.
Oh, what
the
a legend.
Legendary Dr. Maggie Paul.
I didn't know. That's beautiful. Igor, what went through your mind now? I feel like I'm getting the story from Bazazm's perspective here now, but like, what went through your mind when he approached you about doing a ballet?
First of all, it starts when somebody came to me and proposed a collaboration. Because before all my productions, I create by my own. It was a challenge to collaborate with somebody. Especially with the kind of this subject unknown for me. It's culture not unknown for me. Bazazm touched very basic moment. Because when he started kind of briefly tell me about the legend, my first question was, what about music? And he told me, do you know Jerome Datcher at all? No. Listen. And he put this wonderful voice, wonderful original song by Jerome Datcher. And this is the main point to kind of tell. Yes, let's try it.
We have some of Jeremy's music that's in the ballet. Just take a listen to this. Datcher from his Polaris Prize winning album, What is to Wiggle into Waganoa.
Yeah. It's not anymore Datcher. It's not anymore Datcher. It's the main character from the performance.
Oh, is that so?
It's a solo zip from performance. You know, like interested when you create on some music, some composer, and you create character on stage, it's not anymore composer. It's a character.
Oh, yes. Music. Yeah, I understand. But in that moment, I'm sort of picturing like two of you sitting at like an office table with a speaker in between you and playing the music and sort of having this aha moment. Bazazm, is that kind of how it went down?
Exactly, but instead it was the Atlantic Ballet Studio, so it was this big, giant, open space, almost like a stage, and you know, it was echoing all throughout the room, and the sun was shining down, beaming from the window. It's its own legend in its way too.
That's beautiful. And Igor, what went through your mind when you heard that music?
It's a lot of images, you know, like in my mind, music for me very important point of the creativity, impulse, imagination, you know. And this time I start kind of improvise and tell Bazazm, oh my God, this is something like that. And of course, after we start create the storyline.
But Zazen, when does Jeremy come into this? Because I know Jeremy pretty well. I mean, this is a very busy guy. This guy's on the road a lot. He's always working with kind of different organizations all around the world. But Zazen, like, how did you get him into the room? And then what happened when you got him in the room?
Well, you know, Jeremy Datcher and me go way, way, way back. His mom was the nurse in our community as I grew up. And so she went on her journey with my gran, Maggie Paul, a long time ago. You know, at the first friendship centers in Fredericton, and the two of them, you know, really were working together culturally on bringing all of it back, right? And so when I first started this concept and I heard this song, I just literally called Jeremy up that day and I was like, I'd really like to bring you on board, Need Up. I want you in here. And so he came on board pretty early in conceptualization. You know, me and Igor had already kind of picked out a few legends to kind of start from, in the same way that other large stories from any other culture, you know, represents other pieces. We had a baseline to go from, and then Jeremy came in.
I feel like at this point, it's probably not a bad idea to talk through some of the plot here, to talk through some of the story. So, Bazazm, let's stay with you here right now. So tell me a little bit about where this story came from and sort of how you developed it.
Yeah, so this story particularly is going to be a hero's journey. We're going to be following Olmi from his birth onto the stage all the way through a journey of being humbled to realizing the importance of others in, you know, wisdom and humility, and where that power truly comes from. You know, it's not just strength, but all the different elements of the world. And this hero is on this journey to return the spirit of water. And the spirit of water, Sip, is a both metaphysical thing and a very real person on the stage. And if we lived in a world where, you know, water has no spirit, then in the same way as it gets polluted and these adulterations happen to our water, then it's going to get to a point where it will no longer quench your thirst. So there's a lot of depth to it, you know. There's what you see on stage, but then you can read into it in multitude of different ways.
And forgive me for my misunderstanding here. This is, I know this is an original story from you, but sort of based on an older legend.
Exactly, and it's the same way as if, you know, we had George Lucas who went back and learned about some rebellion of indigenous people down in South America, in south end of the United States of America, and, you know, did a wonderful piece on them. We haven't had the ability to show Wollastook work canonly on stage, so we're going to be pulling elements from all sorts of legends and pieces. It's not a direct retelling of one particular legend, but instead elements and themes and philosophy from our people that's never been showcased before.
Igor, what did you think when you heard the story that Bezazen wanted to tell here?
For me, important part of this about people start losing the spirit. And when people lose the spirit, they lose the power to make world better. This is story all about how somebody go on the journey and found power to change the world to the better.
But Bezazem, you are bringing this story into this very classical environment. And my understanding, it was really important for you to have an indigenous lead dancer. Is that right?
That was the whole piece of it when I walked in was, you know, there's not a lot of indigenous ballet dancers in Canada. Actually, we searched across the board and at a professional capacity, there's only as many as you can count on five fingers.
Five, really?
As far as we were able to find in our research. And if they're out there, you know, we're looking forward to seeing what comes out of our work, and we would love to have more of them appear. So this is why we're trying to really be a part of that conversation, not only just as Wollastook, but Indigenous people. You know, we have to do it in a good way in order to create paths for our young ones to come up behind us. You know, it's all about being a good ancestor.
How did you find your lead?
So we have the wonderful Jera Wolf, who, as we were doing our research and looking around, we found a wonderful picture of this amazing dancer standing in front of a great body of water. And he's off staring, you know, very heroically, and his hair is all blowing in the wind on Instagram. And that's when we knew. We were like, let's try him out. Let's see if he would get back to us. And he did. And he was so happy to join and be dancing again. Jera Wolf, of course, having a wonderful career as a choreographer, dancer. You know, he's been all the way across the world and so on. So it's been a joy to have him on board.
I mean, Igor, you've been at this for a long time too, in the dance world, in the ballet world. What was it like for you to work with Jera?
It's wonderful. You know, especially because this production coming with a stylistically more in contemporary way, what actually Jera, the master of this. So, and what happened when they start choreograph him, our dancers, like classical training dancers, watch him, how he's rehearsed, how he's doing some combination, what I set up for him. And then all of a sudden I see they start to repeat, and they go kind of copy his movement.
Oh.
Really, I'm not kidding. I see how they changed. Well, they couldn't change because, you know, this classical training dance, but at least they get this flavor from him. And he amazed me. Like, this is like, you know, I can tell you, he is the dream of any choreographer, especially contemporary. He's doing more than...
Jump in here too, Tom. It's just like, you know, for us at Atlantic Ballet, you know, with the work that we're doing and having him here and working with the dancers, it's like, you know, when things are supposed to happen, you know, and they say like what some people believe in faith, some people destiny. And, you know, we say our ancestors bring them when they're supposed to arrive. Everyone that was supposed to be on this project arrived right on time.
Yeah. They came at the exact right moment.
Exact right moment. And plus, Jera, he's so nice personality. He's working hard. And then the relation, what he has with our dancers, amazing, just amazing. I can tell you, it's a super time to work with him.
Igor, it sounds like you're a bit changed by all this process here. You seem like you've been learning a lot and taking a lot in.
Well, I don't know if my close to the 60, can I change? Maybe. Maybe. I hope. To the better shit, but definitely I got something in my luggage for sure.
That's beautiful. Bazazm, last word to you here. I mean, your community has played such a big role in bringing this story to life. I mean, for generations and generations and generations, but also including behind the scenes in the production happening right now. What do you hope largely might come out of this experience?
You know, it's as, you know, we have been saying for a long time, It's our time. It's the time of our people. You know, we have to look around us and see all the wealth that this nation has and all the beauty around us. And I'm looking forward to moving this way so that others can come up behind me.
What are you most looking forward to on the premiere night?
Honestly, I told the dancers and I told the crew, I said, you know, Indigenous audiences aren't like Western audiences. I said, if they're quiet, we're not doing our job right. So if we don't hear Maggie Paul's voice cut through that crowd, then we got to kick it up a notch.
you'll have real... So
that's what I'm going to be waiting for.
You'll have a little sound meter backstage, keeping an eye out for it. Well, I ever since I heard, I think ever since Jeremy first told me about this project, I've been so looking forward to talking to you about it. I've been so excited to have it happen, and I hope I get a chance to see it. Congratulations to the both of you, and thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you.
Bazazm Paul is a multidisciplinary artist from Sundances First Nation. He is also director of Indigenous programming at the Atlantic Ballet. Igor Dobrovolsky is the creative director at Atlantic Ballet. They are the co-directors of a new ballet called Bizowin, which is on tour now in New Brunswick. You can go to atlanticballet.ca for all the details.
Scrolling on my phone again, double tapping Instagram. I don't really like how I feel. Watching someone else's life, then I go comparing mine to a glossy highlight reel. And it's always sunny.
I can relate. I know you can relate too. That is Jill Barber with a song called Beautiful Life. I'm Tom Power, you're listening to Q. For a lot of Canadian musicians, the pandemic led to a hard look at your life, your lifestyle, what it means and costs to tour across this massive country, what it means at all just to make a living at art. These are some of the questions Jill Barber was thinking about as she wrote and recorded her brand new album, Homemaker, which is sort of a departure. Up until now, Jill's been making a lot of like jazzy orchestral music in recent years, and this is a much more stripped back, more acoustic record. One that honestly is probably easier to take on the road in 2023. And when I said that in front of Jill when I was introducing her, I noticed she was like nodding furiously. So we get into that. Here's my conversation with Jill Barber. Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's very well. Thank you, Tom.
When I said, it's nice to have you here. When I said it's a little bit easier to take on the road, I saw out of the corner of my eye, I saw this massive head nod.
It is easier to take on the road.
The more, but this to me is similar. I so you know this because I feel like whenever I see you, I bother you by talking to you about how much I loved your first few records, the ones that in Nova Scotia, the country records.
It's no bother, Tom.
Okay, but you know what I mean. Like I feel this record sounded more like akin to that kind of stuff. I thought, you know,
absolutely, this record is very much a return to my folky singer-songwriter roots. It's very stripped down.
Yeah. I have your first EP. Is it A Note to Follow So an EP?
That's amazing. Yes. I hand screen printed and hand cut and glued every single one of those copies and stamped them with number stamped them. So
I have one.
Yeah.
I got it from Judd Haynes, who was my next door neighbor.
Yeah.
I was very, very pleased to have one of those.
Amazing.
So talk to me a little bit about what was going through your mind during that shutdown then.
Well, as you well know, a career in music requires constant momentum and, you know, fueling the momentum by writing new songs, recording new albums, releasing them, doing the whole cycle, getting out on the road, playing them. And I had been doing that for most of my adult life,
yeah,
all of my professional life. And so in March 2020, when that ground instantly to a halt, I found myself at home with my two young kids and my husband and off the road with no return to the stage in sight. And these two identities that I'd kind of been balancing in my life, one of my domestic life and one of my professional touring life, they kind of collided into one. And I was faced with confronting what it means to be just a homemaker. I asked myself that question. Okay, if I'm not a touring musician, well, am I just a homemaker? And then I spent, well, this whole album writing my way therapeutically through those feelings and trying to get rid of the just part. And then I wanted to...
Hold on, say that again. You're trying to get rid of the just part? What do you mean by
I'm
that?
Oh, I'm sorry. The just a homemaker.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I wanted to uplift and empower myself as a homemaker. I wanted to switch the narrative on what it means to be a person who creates a home for other people, a safe space, a place for others to thrive. And I don't mean just parents, but caregivers,
yeah,
of all sorts. And I feel like that work is so often overlooked, underpaid, and it's often unseen, but it's actually like the most important, meaningful work that anyone can do in a society to take care of others.
Right, because I think that term, you're right, that term is seen as a diminutive or a bit of a condescending term.
It has been.
Gendered condescending term.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Historically.
That's right.
And you say to yourself, I want to explore, actually, this is a really important role.
Homemaker is a role that so many people embody and so few artists and musicians sing about. I was like, as a mother of young kids and as a woman in a long-term, highly domesticated relationship, I wasn't hearing myself represented in so much music out there. So
yeah.
I set out to try to, to try to write music that I know so many people can relate to as people in middle age, people with young kids, and people in long-term relationships. And so for me, the great sense of satisfaction was just having made the record. But now that I'm on the road touring it, there's a whole other level that I'm experiencing now, which is sharing these songs and really, really feeling them resonate with other people. And I've been having a lot of like hugs with strangers.
What are they saying to you?
Sometimes they're not even saying anything. There was a woman the other night at the show who came up to me afterwards and she just had eyes full of tears.
Yeah.
And she couldn't really get any words out. And I just naturally kind of opened up my arms and she came in for a hug and we just shared a hug. And no words needed to be spoken.
But you saw...
I saw that it hit somewhere for her. It hit her in a way that brought forth tears, and I wanted to share her tears. I did a little bit, I think. Even I have kind of when I see tears in someone else's eyes, I can well up. We just had a moment. We didn't even need to say anything. We just understood each other.
Tell me about the song we're gonna listen to. We're gonna listen to the title track.
This song is the first song that I wrote after my son and daughter went back to school and daycare, respectively, after that prolonged stretch at home with me. I dropped them off in the morning, and then I came home to an empty house.
Yeah.
And I first of all, I think I kind of laughed hysterically, like a maniac, not knowing what to do. And and then I think I collapsed on my couch and had a big cry. I wept. I just wept. I just needed that release. And then I dried my eyes and I picked up my guitar for the first time in a long time, and I wrote this song.
What lines came to you right away?
Well, the first one, which was the theme. It feels like the theme. I spend half my life doing dishes, it seems. So
that line just came out of you?
Yeah. The first line of the song is, dishes won't do themselves, and they won't. They sit there until someone does them. So yeah, that line just that line came to me, and then actually the song just flowed right out of me. It was one of those lucky moments as a songwriter where a song just flows. It's not. I didn't labor over it. It just it flowed out.
I can tell how much this means to you. I can tell how much this record means to you. I can tell what a personal record this is to you and what an important record this is to you.
It is, and I'm glad you can tell, and I hope it means something to anyone out there listening who needs to hear it too.
How about you introduce it, Casey Kasem style here?
Hi, this is Jill Barber, and here is my song, Homemaker.
Dishes won't do themselves. Dust upon the shelves, and time's impossible to find. Is anybody gonna help tidy up these toys, pour the clutter in my mind? If all you wanna do is run, I won't. Secret fantasy. If all you wanna do is cry, I won't even ask why. I'll just hold the box of tissues for you.
Port Credit, Ontario. Lived in Halifax for a little while, now making her home in Vancouver, British Columbia. That is Jill Barber and Homemaker from her album of the same name. All right, that is it for the show today. Tomorrow on the show, Rainn Wilson, or Dwight from The Office, on his new book about spirituality. We'll see you then, later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.